This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Billy Ingram spent years working in California for big Hollywood film studios. If you went to the movies between mid-80s and mid-90s, you've probably seen his work. He did movie posters featuring stars including Harrison Ford and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Eventually, he left the business, settled down in Greensboro, where he began his new venture, TVParty.com. It's a website dedicated to classic television. He also started publishing books. His latest is an oral history called Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, about two sisters who joined Dean Martin's troupe of female performers, the Gold Diggers, and they did that in the 1970s, and Billy Ingram is here now in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Who are the Gold Diggers?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask that. It's always a simple question that are so difficult. Well, this group of Gold Diggers was a reinvention of the Gold Diggers that started in 1966. They were a sexy, sophisticated girl group that would appear on Dean Martin's shows, and they also opened for him in Las Vegas. But they had a grueling touring schedule. So the group sort of fell apart in 1972, and this Beyond Our Wildest Dreams picks up the story where Maria Lauren and the Alberici sisters, Maria and Linda, joined the Gold Diggers in 1973 when they got rid of all the old girls and brought in a whole new group of girls.
And this is the time of sort of really big entertainment. TV, there's three networks. It's a lot more broad spectrum in terms of the kind of entertainment. And this was the sort of thing, the Rat Pack, you know, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, and a group of beautiful girls,
yeah.
You know, dancing behind them, right?
And, yeah, but, I don't think there's been a more unfortunate name for a group, the Gold Diggers, because these really were super hardworking girls. They had a grueling touring schedule. They had 2 one-hour shows that they had to do. And, Frank, you wouldn't believe it. They're dancing, singing all over the stage. Doing all these medleys, and this is before wireless mics. So they had these long microphone cords behind them, and they never ever. It was so tightly choreographed; they never ever got them mixed up.
They were good. They were talented.
They were super sophisticated in terms of how talented they were, in addition to being beautiful.
Tell us about the Alberici sisters. Who were they, and how did they get connected?
What a great story! Because in the beginning, now these two ladies grew up in the 1950s, right around the same time that a lot of us did. But their father was a very strict Italian household. No meat, no sugar, no bread, no white flour.
What kind of Italian household has no meat?
Macrobiotic diet.
Wow.
Totally. They got goat's milk from the farm, and they made their own. Everything was fresh and natural. Almost never went out to eat. The girls had never really been out on a date. They'd been out on one date, prom, chaperone. Then in 1973, they get hired to fly to Hollywood, have never been on a plane, never been in a restaurant practically, and join the Gold Diggers, I mean, of all groups, with Dean Martin. They were shot up into the upper stratosphere of the entertainment business overnight.
How much showbiz had they been involved in before this?
Well, they were in high school.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
they'd done high school plays.
And off they go.
Maria had won some beauty contests, and Linda did too. She was very, very, they're both still beautiful women. She won the Miss Philadelphia contest, and she went on from there. She was almost Miss World.
So they're beautiful, they're talented, they go on, they become Gold Diggers. How big a deal were they at this point?
Well, huge, because they not only appeared on Dean's show, they also opened for Dean in Vegas. Now, this was a time period, the 1970s. We cover mostly between 73 and 79 because I like the ending of things. And this is the end of Las Vegas as we knew it. The end of the whole era of show business that started in the 1930s with vaudeville, 1940s in radio, 50s and 60s in television. It all sort of dissipated at the end of the 70s. At this time, you had huge nightclubs all over the place. All the big hotels, the Fairmont chain, had huge showrooms where they had acts come in from all over the country. So every week, if you lived in a big city or even someplace like Cherry Hill, New Jersey, you could see the biggest stars right there in your own hometown, and you weren't in an amphitheater type of experience. So audiences got to see the Gold Diggers and the stars really up close.
And, of course, because of this is the era of network television, we say three networks, so that you're
right.
Pretty much locked in, captive audience. They're also profiled on shows like The Mike Douglas Show.
Here they are, the Gold Diggers.
Soda. And then there's more. And then there's more. And then there's more.
There we go. go. Gold Diggers on the Mike Douglas Show. And that's Maria Loren doing the lead, right? She's one of the Alberici sisters.
Oh, yeah.
And you were about to say that the fact that they were on shows like the Mike Douglas Show.
Yeah, the Mike Douglas Show. And they did quite a bit of television. And but really, for the most part, they were out on the road touring. And that was what sort of destroyed the first group of Gold Diggers. They were great for TV and everything, but when it had to be out on the road 50 weeks out of the year, that's a very special thing.
Now, when you search them and you try to find clips, as we did, I noticed a group. I don't remember the Gold Diggers, mm-hmm. but then there's another kind of a subgroup called the Ding-a-lings.
The Ding-a-lings. Yeah, well, Greg Garrison, who was the producer of the Dean Martin Show and also produced the Gold Diggers. The Gold Diggers, at that time, there were 12 girls, and he had them out on the road. He had them in Vegas, and he said, we're making some money here. Why don't we take some of the girls out of the Gold Diggers and start another group? They took four of them out and started the Ding-a-lings, the Ding-a-ling sisters. And that's an even more insulting name.
Even more insulting name, and yet these are – it's an act in its own right, which is one of the interesting things to me. It was not just a backup group, as you suggest.
Yes.
They're on tour, and they're doing their own stuff.
Oh, they were headliners, yeah.
Now, is there much influence – do they have much influence today, do you think?
The Gold Diggers well, Maria and Linda, who I wrote this, I produced the book, Beyond Our Wildest Dreams, they're very much involved in a lot of different things. They started a group called Showstoppers, where some of the former Gold Diggers would get up and do medleys of some of the shows that songs that they used to do in the old shows. So they're still active. And there's a new Gold Diggers group with the first group of Gold Diggers. I think there's a new group that's playing Vegas every once in a while.
They also went on a little-known tour with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. Tell us about that.
Well, that's crazy because I interviewed the author, the definitive author of one of the Rat Pack books, I won't embarrass him, and I asked him, I said, what about this 1977 tour with Frank and Dean? Because Dean never traveled. He didn't have to. Dean didn't care. He played Vegas. He played Tahoe and did TV, and that was it. I mean, he barely did TV. He would just show up in the afternoons after playing golf and run through the show. That was it. So what were we talking about?
You're talking about this tour that nobody seems to know
about.
Yeah,
and so I asked him about it. He says, I don't know anything about this tour. Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, and the Gold Diggers went out on a one-month tour, Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and a couple of spots in New York State, and then in Chicago. And fortunately, some people put their tape recorders on the tables, and I was able to find a lot of the shows that they did. And it was just a fantastic show. This was a few years after Frank Sinatra's so-called retirement. Mm-hmm. And people had written off his voice as being gone. But I tell you, listening to those recordings, I think he was really at his peak then. It was a real tenderness to his voice at that time. And his song sets were just magnificent.
There was also the summer tour that included comedian Henny Youngman. And there's a story about that that's more than a one-liner.
Well, actually, it's George Jessel. There was a thing called the Roy Radin Review. And Roy Radin loved vaudeville so much that he recreated vaudeville. And he took these stars that were on they were mostly drunk. Their careers were falling apart. We're talking about Donald O'Connor, who at that time had an alcohol problem, Milton Berle, George Jessel, the Ink Spots, and like that. So they would go out on a big bus tour and do a show at a different night in a different town. It was grueling. But somehow the Gold Diggers got booked on two of these tours. Well, Tim Fowler, who was the music director, told me this story. Donald O'Connor was walking past George Jessel's door. And George Jessel was known as the Toastmaster General. He was an old guy. He's 90 years old. So he sees his door's ajar. So Donald O'Connor pokes his head in. He goes, hey, George, your door's... And he sees George lying on the bed with his Toastmaster General hat on and nothing else. Stark naked. He goes, what's going on? And Jessel's like, well, I get lucky sometimes. Sometimes I get lucky. So anyway, one day, Donald O'Connor and George Goble are walking down the hall. And a maid had gone into George Jessel's room, came out screaming, ah! She's hanging on to, she's like, oh my God, it's George Jessel, and he's naked. And she looks up and she goes, oh my God, you're Donald O'Connor. And she grabs hold of George Goble. Oh my God, you're George Goble from the Hollywood Squares. And she goes screaming off down the hall.
Wow. And he did this, apparently, this is like the practical joke, just to sort of get that reaction.
Yeah,
and
he was a dirty old man.
Dirty
you
old
know,
man
Linda,
when
he was out on tour, Linda was very beautiful. He goes, would you give an old man a little kiss on the cheek? And she goes to do it, and he turns his face around and tries to French kiss her.
That must have been just a nightmare tour for those women with those kind of has-been guys who had.
Well, it was recruiters. Interesting. I think they learned a lot, especially working with people like Milton Berle, who was really very – and Donald O'Connor. The second year that Donald O'Connor did the tour, the first year he was completely drunk. The next year he was getting his sobriety together. So I think that they saw a lot of cautionary tales there and saw maybe the seedier side of show business at that point.
How did this book come about?
Well, it looks to me like the internet is not going to work for little guys like me anymore. I think the corporate structure, they're just going to squeeze guys like me. So I thought, let me get back into publishing because the first book that I did, TV Party, did really well. I went on a book tour. I landed a TV show on VH1 and then on Bravo. And so the girls had written an article for TV Party about their experiences with the Gold Diggers, and I thought, and I wanted to do an oral history, and I thought that would be a great thing to do if they would, you know, share their story to do this oral history. And I interviewed, you know, dozens of people, transcribed 1,000 hours of interviews. And I just wanted to see if I could create a book with no narration, just from people's conversations, and have it be a cohesive storyline. I'm not sure if I succeeded, but that was a goal.
Well, that tries to capture that era. How would you characterize that? That was a sort of phenomenal era where these characters and their flaws and vices were, particularly with the Rat Pack. I mean, this was part of the charm, if you will.
Yeah, they were getting older, and again, it goes back to my fascination with how things end, and I'm really fascinated with how careers end, how Vegas morphed into a corporate thing that it is today. So that really I found to be one of the more fascinating stories. And I wanted it to be a microcosm of that period, and so that it would stand in sharp contrast to the entertainment industry today, which is completely different, 180 degrees.
What ended in Vegas? You talk about it being corporate.
Yeah, well,
now.
It was run by the mob. But the Hilton Corporation in 1976, I think it was, wanted to get into Las Vegas. They had to change some laws to be able to do it. And they built the first high-rise hotel in Las Vegas, the MGM Grand. They signed Dean Martin, and Dean Martin and the Gold Diggers opened the first night. The MGM Grand was one of the biggest nights ever in Las Vegas, the first high-rise hotel. But before that point, the mob had a lot of money, but they didn't have the kind of mega bucks that you needed to open up an MGM Grand or a Bellagio, you know, down the line. So the mob was squeezed out simply because the corporations had a great deal more money than the mob did, and they got moved out of their own town.
One group of organized criminals replacing another. I don't know why you're nostalgic about it.
Don't write to me, write to Frank Station.
And
send your hit people.
Oh no, you got to see the way they play their game up there. We still haven't recovered from their last little bit of mayhem. Those organized fellows on Wall Street. Well, you were designing posters before this. What? Tell us about the poster, and how'd you get involved in that? These are the movie posters, right?
Yeah, it was another fluke. I was running a publishing company, and it was just gone belly up, and not through my fault. I only ended up running it because everybody fled for the doors once they realized it was going broke. And my assistant, who was a terrible artist, went to work for Cyanager Advertising, which I knew was the top company in Hollywood for doing movie posters, so much so that they had an unlisted number and you didn't even know where they were. But I knew where they were, and I dropped off my resume, and they called me before I even got home, and I started working. I was just, you know, I wasn't a trained artist, but these hands had to be Photoshopped back then. This is before Photoshop. So an art director would say, okay, I want Arnold Schwarzenegger jumping out of a helicopter with an Uzi in each hand and three women hanging off his legs, and I want it to look like a Norman Rockwell painting, and I want the city of New York to be exploding underneath him, and I would have to go and do that with photographs, color Xeroxes, body double shoots, Chromatex, the typography all had to be there. These 7x9 comps had to look like a printed piece, like you just tore it out of a magazine. Because no indications, no nothing.
So it's a real art form, but it's a kind of a bridge form, because it goes from, you know, hand painted posters, right? Not too many decades before.
Yes.
So it's an art form that doesn't really have much of a history in terms of.
Yeah. Once you were able to manipulate photographs more easily, the painted movie poster started to die off. I was working next to one of the greatest movie poster artists of all time, Dave Christensen, who did Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase being electrocuted on the roof, and the Vegas Vacation with him on the, and the Mohawk baseball for Major League, and yeah. I'm just Driving Miss Daisy was another poster that he worked on that we both worked on together, but we manipulated photographs. I was not an artist in the sense that I could draw. I could draw a little bit, but that wasn't what I was hired to do. I was hired to manipulate photographs and make everything, you know,
Make it look real so you can't see the seams and all the fake stuff. I love the idea that you work for a company with an unlisted number. This is a sign company with no sign.
Well, it's not a sign company. No, this is a boutique. This was an advertising and marketing boutique. We did the trailers and the movie posters for all the biggest studios, but that was all we did.
You got a story about one assignment you had I guess the way this comes about, because, you know, the studio may want to see a mock-up and, you know, get some idea what you're headed toward. And this didn't always turn out to be the poster that they used.
Oh, we did hundreds of them. We would do, and there'd be three agencies working on every project. For the film Bugsy, they spent, I think, $2 million to develop the poster. We must have produced 300 or 400 comps, fully realized comps. We had to do an overnighter because the guy from, I forget the studios, called over to Tony and said, I forgot, I've got a meeting tomorrow morning with who's the guest star, Warren Beatty. And I promised him 100 comps, and I need them by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So it was all hands on deck that night to produce 100 different beautiful comps.
And they're expensive.
I don't even know what Tony made that. He probably made $500,000.
And they ended up not using any of them.
Yeah, they ended up with just using a Harry Langdon shot and simple typography. They could have gone to the mall and gotten it shot.
So now what brought you to Greensboro?
Well, you know, Photoshop was coming into vogue, and I knew that I was a dinosaur, and I didn't want to sit in front of a computer all day. That was my thinking at the time. So I thought, let me go back to Greensboro, get a normal job, and do some writing. I want to be a writer now. I've done the artist thing. And I got here to Greensboro. Nobody would hire me, which turned out to be the greatest thing that could have possibly happened, because I'd reached inside of myself. And I said, if I'm good enough to work for the biggest stars in Hollywood, surely I can come up with something for myself. And I did. I came up with TV Party, and eventually it became a moneymaker. I had a web design. I used it to show people I could design on the internet. We're talking 1994, 1995. Nobody even practically knew what the internet was all about, and nobody was getting their websites produced, but we were doing it. Started a company, and then in 01, I decided, I don't want to be a website. What am I doing? And so I chucked the business, and I put everything in storage, and I moved to London. And when I got there, I had 10 pounds in my pocket, and it was 9-11. It was 9-11 happened that day.
That's a bad place to be broke anytime. Billy Ingram.
No, it was great. It turned out to be the most fantastic thing ever.
Thanks so much for being on the
Thank
program.
You.
Billy Ingram, founder of TVParty.com, publisher of the new book Beyond Our Wildest Dreams. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Alex Granados. Megan Modafari is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.